Turn with me this evening to Job chapter 9. Job chapter 9, our study resumes at verse 5. In case you missed our last study, Job, you'll recall, is responding to the speech made by his friend Bildad in the previous chapter, beginning with an acknowledgement that Bildad was correct in stating that God does not pervert justice or act unjustly. In short, as I said last time, Job is saying, you're correct, Bildad. God always does what is right where man is concerned. But the real question is, how can a man be right where God is concerned? We then spent the rest of our time talking about the fact that there's only one way for a man to be right with God, and that is to be redeemed by God. That's to be clothed in the righteous robes of the Lord Jesus Christ. If left to ourselves to stand before God on our own recognizance, none of us could stand. The only thing that makes it possible for us to stand before God, again, is the finished work of Jesus Christ and our being clothed in His righteous robes. Last week I gave you a few passages that speak to the importance of the imputed righteousness of Christ. 1 Corinthians 1:30, 2 Corinthians 5:21, Romans 3:26. But I neglected to mention what Paul wrote to the Philippians in Philippians 3, 7 through 9. So you can kind of jot that down as an additional reference. In case you're not familiar with that, let me just read it to you. Paul says, whatever things were gained to me, those things I have counted as loss for the sake of Christ. More than that, I count all things to be loss in view of the surpassing value of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things, and count them but rubbish, so that I may gain Christ and may be found in Him, not having a righteousness of my own derived from the law, but that which is through faith in Christ, the righteousness which comes from God on the basis of faith. Now, as I said at the end of my last message, Job's understanding of this kind of thing was only beginning to materialize. He's in the infant stages, really, not just in terms of his own walk with the Lord, but he's in the infant stages as it pertains to mankind as a whole. Again, the aperture of God's revelation was only slightly opened by this point. He didn't have the Word of God that we have at our disposal. What he knew, he was able to glean, as was indicated by Bildad. He was able to glean some wisdom from the ancients. He no doubt was able to glean a great deal by natural revelation. We'll talk about that more in just a minute. But again, in terms of his being very precise in his theological understanding, nobody was at the time. And aren't you blessed? Aren't you and I blessed to know as much as we know now about how God deals in the realm of mankind, how God saves sinners, and how he keeps us in the palm of his hand, and so on and so forth. Job didn't have that benefit again. And this is what caused kind of the turbulence between him and his friends, so-called. His friends, at least the first two, Eliphaz in the first place and Bildad most recently, his friends seem to be indicating that the troubles experienced by Job were likely due to some kind of sin that he had committed. They probably never imagined that God would simply do things like this or allow things like this to befall people if there wasn't some punishment behind it or some means of dealing with their sin. Little did they know, as we've talked about a couple of times now, little did they know God was doing these things to make a point. God was doing these things to prove his own ability to save Job to the uttermost and preserve Job in the process. Remember what Satan's main accusation was. Let me at him. I'll have him cursing you to your face. God says, have at it. Do anything you want to him, but don't take his life. And thus far, again, I mean that very literally, because next week, Job's going to get a little bit accusatory. Not tonight, but next week. But thus far, Job's doing really well. in spite of all the things that had befallen him. Can you imagine? I mean, again, think about the level, the intensity of suffering that he's been placed under. And he's come through it so far very admirably, right? So again, nobody knew that except God alone. Job didn't even know that, which again is why he's going to start questioning all this in future studies. But as Job says in verse 3, he says, it really doesn't matter why anyone goes through what I'm going through, because if one wished to dispute with God, he could not answer him once in 1,000 times. Job says, look, if I were to approach God 1,000 times with 1,000 different arguments for why I shouldn't be going through this, I know one thing for certain. Whatever God ordains is going to happen. He has thus ordained this, and so it would be a fool's errand to try to approach him and make my own case, to plead out of this thing. When appearing in God's court of justice, he says, whether the charges against man be one or 1,000, they are what they are. Why? Because God is immutable. God is sovereign in the affairs of man. And so, I mean, I think we can all learn a valuable lesson from this. Whatever befalls us is happening to us for our good and for God's glory. Although we don't understand that fully, although we can't wrap our brains around every subtle nuance of that statement, we know, we have to know that that's true. Anyway, Job goes on to say in verse 4, wise in heart and mighty in strength, who has defied him without harm? Of course, that's a purely rhetorical question. Nobody defies God, or at least remains in a condition of defiance, an attitude of defiance, and gets away with it. Now, it might seem like they do, but what does the Lord say repeatedly in the Old Testament? Especially, he says, I will exact vengeance when I decide to exact vengeance. He demonstrates that time and time again. While we would lash out and expect God to exact his vengeance on his enemies and ours immediately, it's not the way it works. God says, vengeance is mine. I will repay. When? When I get good and ready. Because I'm God and you're not, right? But the bottom line is, Job's absolutely right. No man has been able to defy or harden himself against God without harm, because again, God's purposes cannot and will not be thwarted, no matter how we might feel about those things. Now, as an example of the futility of puny man's futile attempts to contend with God, Job gives us some examples here of far greater powers, far greater things that are incapable of doing that. He begins here in verse 5. Read with me. He says, it is God who removes the mountains. They know not how, when he overturns them in his anger, who shakes the earth out of its place, and its pillars tremble. Now, of course, Job's meaning is clear. You look at the mighty mountains. I talked last time about the Swiss Alps, and you know, perhaps you've been to the Colorado Rockies, and you've seen the magnificence of God's handiwork in mountains and things of that nature, and you kind of feel small, don't you, when you're standing in the midst of such glory and grandeur. And Job's meaning is, look at the mountains. God is able to remove them. Who are you to stand against the Lord? Even the mountains, he says, can't stand against the Lord. Job's reference here is thought to be either a reference to earthquakes or volcanic eruptions, which, by the way, volcanic eruptions were quite common in the area in which Job lived. There are at least 7 volcanoes that are around the land where we think Uz was. There are 7 and perhaps even as many as 12. And so volcanic eruptions were quite common in that region and certainly during Job's lifetime. Many of us remember a particular demonstration of God's power in this regard with the eruption of Mount St. Helens. That was back in 1980. Yes, children, slightly before the earth began to cool. Bingo. Yeah. Mount St. Helens, in case you're not aware, is in Washington State. And the eruption of Mount St. Helens was quite the spectacle. It marks the most violent, most damaging eruption in North America to this date. It has not been surpassed either before or after. But just how destructive was it? Well, let me give you some facts. I like facts. I don't know about you, but this just further makes the point that Job's making here about the fact that nothing can stand against God or defy Him. It's estimated that 1 cubic mile of rock. Now, if you don't know what a cubic mile of rock is, imagine a cube, every side being a mile across. That much rock, 12% of the mountain, was removed during the eruption. The mountain's elevation was reduced in the span of less than 10 seconds. The mountain's elevation was reduced by 1,370 feet. That's impressive. Now, what does that look like in practical terms? Well, here's some more quick facts for you. The outward blast spread volcanic debris over 230 square miles. 230 square miles. It blew down 4 billion board feet of timber. The eruption column, the plume that shot up into heaven, rose to 80,000 feet. That's 15 miles straight up. The ash from the plume, the explosion, the ash was deposited in 11 U.S. states and a certain part of Canada as well. What are you doing? Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, you think the wildfires in Africa or the sandstorms in Africa are a nuisance. I mean, this ash made its way all the way around the world. Absolutely. The thermal energy, now this is, I'm about to blow your minds. If you're not awake, wake up. The thermal energy released in this one eruption was equal to 26 megatons of TNT. If you're not sure what a megaton is 1 million tons. This eruption resulted in an explosion the equivalent of 26 million tons of dynamite. Tons. A ton's 2,000 pounds. Right? To better understand this, the nuclear bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima to end World War II was only equivalent of 15,000 tons of TNT. So if you do the math, this means that Mount St. Helens erupted with a force of more than 1,700 Hiroshima bombs. That's just a small demonstration of God's ability to move mountains, to displace mountains. And again, you have to ask, who are we to think that we can stand against this God? To think that we can defy this God? That's Job's point. If you really want to be afraid, and you should be, I was doing, as I studied, you know, I'm like the guy reading the cereal box. I got to read every letter, you know. Then I got to get online and find out more, and it's a vortex for me a lot of times. But I got to looking at this, and one of the people talking about Mount St. Helens also talked about the Yellowstone supervolcano. And he said, if you really want something to be afraid of, it's not Mount St. Helens. It's the Yellowstone supervolcano. The Yellowstone supervolcano, which could erupt at any time. They just don't know, right? Again, not to scare you. The Yellowstone supervolcano, when it erupts, will do so with 2,000 times the force of Mount St. Helens. Yeah. Again, all this to say that Job's exactly right. If God can remove mountains, and He can, as a demonstration of His righteous anger, man is simply no match for Him. Incidentally, this phrase, they know not how, it's a Hebraism. It's a personification of the mountains themselves. He does this before the mountains themselves are even aware that it's being done. Now, they don't have any sort of cognition, but you get the idea. He does this when He wants to do it and as thoroughly as He plans to do it. Even such that if the mountains could recognize what was going on, it would be done before they were able even to grasp that. This same God, Job goes on to say in verse 7, also commands the sun not to shine and sets a seal upon the stars. Now, what does that mean exactly? Most scholars are actually divided on what this means. There are a lot of reasons the sun might not shine. A lot of natural reasons, right? We think of clouds. In that region, we'd certainly think of sandstorms. You know, having spent a lot of my youth in West Texas, I can tell you right now, sandstorms got so bad, you couldn't see, 3 feet in front of your car driving down the highway. It's that bad. Especially when a haboob comes in, which is a large wall of sand that makes its way across the landscape. You can't see anything. There's eclipses. Eclipses blot out the sun for a time. There's also miraculous events, though. Remember on the day when Jesus was crucified from noon until 3 o'clock, it became completely dark. Now, people try to come up with rational explanations for that, but even eclipses don't last that long, as we saw only recently. I mean, I remember I got my snacks, went out in my garage. Of course, it was cloudy, right? Couldn't see the eclipse itself, but it was kind of cool to be able to sit in my garage, at 1:30 in the afternoon and it'd be like 9 o'clock at night, But even that didn't last very long before it was light again. But God is capable, if He so desires, to blot out the sun, to darken the sun at His command. Again, we can't be sure exactly what Job's talking about. We do know, however, that Job understood that God was sovereignly in control of everything in the universe, including the sun. And He is. So what does it mean for God to set a seal upon the stars? Well, this is kind of tricky. We need to understand that seals back during this particular time frame, and even well into later days, seals were often used as locks. I think even today we use seals to lock certain things. I remember back during my days in the post office back at Ramstein in Germany, we would use metal seals to seal mail containers that contain registered mail or precious cargo. And that was meant to lock the contents away from anybody who might be inclined to steal those things. This is the way Job likely is using this same word. He sets a seal upon the stars. In other words, he's able to do with the stars exactly what he's able to do with the sun. He's able to blot out their light by whatever means is being referred to here. Again, we have no way of knowing that. Verses 8 and 9, Job continues. He notes that God alone stretches out the heavens and tramples down the waves of the sea. He makes the bear, Orion, and the Pleiades, and the chambers of the south. Now, verse 8 is easy enough to understand, right? Job's simply saying that God alone is responsible for the expanse of the heavens that we see above us. He's even sovereign over the waves of the sea. Which, by the way, when you talked about the waves of the sea during Job's day, they were still very mysterious. Unless you were a Phoenician or perhaps a Viking at the time, you weren't a seafaring people. And so waves were among the most frightening, unpredictable things in the imagination. And that's Job's whole point. God even controls the mighty waves. We actually see an example of this on a couple occasions with Jesus himself, do we not? It was Jesus who walked on the water, showing his utter command over the water. It was Jesus who calmed the storm. I mean, who but God in the midst of a raging storm when all of your shipmates are trembling and cowering and Jesus is doing what? Sleeping. He sees what trouble this is causing those who are unable to sleep, and what does he do? He looks up over the boat and says, "Peace, be still." And the whole sea becomes like a sheet of glass. Who can do that but God? That's the kind of thing Job's talking about here. Even the mighty waves that would kill you and me in an instant, they're no match for God. They cannot stand against God. Now, what's not so easy to understand is Job's reference here to God's making the bear. I believe in the King James it's a reference to Arcturus. Is it the bear in the King James? Well, we have Orion. Arcturus, yes. Thank you very much. I thought so. Orion, the Pleiades, the Chambers of the South. Just so you know, the Chambers of the South, back then, astronomers were well aware, even at this point in antiquity, that there was a northern and southern hemisphere. They knew that there was, as they looked south, they knew that there was something beyond what they were able to see. And this was not only true in terms of the landmass, it was also true in terms of the heavens. And there are certain constellations, certain star formations that are not visible in the northern, but they are visible in the southern hemisphere, if you're not aware of that. Astronomy back during this time, you might be surprised to learn, was very highly developed. There's a lot of really good documentaries about things like Stonehenge, things like... I can't remember the names of them. The South Americans, the Incans, the Aztecs were very, very astronomically minded, as well as astrologically minded. But we're just talking about the science of astronomy now. The Persians, modern day Iran, very advanced in math and astronomy. The Magi, who were following the star that was to signify Jesus' birth, were top-notch astronomers. So they had grown very early on in man's existence. They had become able to predict seasons by which they would plant. They were able to recognize the winter solstice. They were able to do all kinds of calculations as far as making calendars and things like that, by what they were able to observe in the heavens. I'm not going to get into all the astronomical information that I wanted to get into tonight concerning the Pleiades and Orion. I mean, all that stuff's fascinating. I would encourage you to do your own study in that regard. But I think it's very interesting that here Job is using these references really kind of in an offhanded way to signify that, yeah, we know about these things. You know, what we think are modern scientific advancements. You know, it's funny that it's kind of ironic that today scientists of the highest caliber are just now starting to decode and decipher what they knew back then. A lot of it's still a mystery even to us today, how they did this and how they did that and how they were able to chart with such precision. Remember, circumnavigation of the globe, at least partial circumnavigation, I don't know. There's rumor that the Chinese went all the way around the globe long before Christopher Columbus was ever born, right? But it was all done by what? by the stars. I don't think that's something that's, today we have GPS, right? But back then they were able to just, with various tools, look at the stars and orient themselves, which enabled them to go from place to place with pinpoint accuracy. I mean, you put me in the middle of an ocean, I'm dead. Day or night, I'm dying there, right? I mean, I have no idea what's going on, but they did. They were very intelligent in that regard. Anyway, Job is simply acknowledging here, again, that since God exercises sovereignty even over such celestial wonders, any attempt for mere mortal man to defy him is really the height of folly. He continues along this theme in verse 10, saying that God is the one who does great things, unfathomable, and wondrous works without number. This is really Job's catch-all, right? He says, I've talked about a few things like the celestial wonders and the mountains and the sea, but let me just make a catch-all statement here by saying that God does great, unfathomable, and wondrous things without number. This is why he goes on in verse 11 to say, were he to pass by me, I would not see him. Were he to move past me, I would not perceive him. What does that mean exactly? Well, listen to Albert Barnes. He's helpful here. Albert Barnes says, in other words, he passes along as in the silent movements of the heavenly bodies. He says, I see the evidence of his existence. I can see that God must be there, moving along by me in the orbs of night and in the march of the constellations, but I can't see God himself. He passes by, or rather he passes over me, as in the majestic movement of the heavenly bodies over my head. Barnes says, this is, I think, the idea, and the image is exceedingly poetic and beautiful. The heavens are seen to move in silent grandeur. The northern constellation rolls around the pole. The others move on as a marshaled army. They go in silent and solemn order, and God must be there. But, says Job, I cannot see him. I can feel that he must be there. And I look out on the heavens to see him, but my eyes fail, and I cannot behold him. He passes on, and I see him not. Who has ever looked upon the heavens in the still night and seen the silent grandeur of such movements of the heavenly host without some such feeling, some emotion of inexpressible awe, as if he, if I might so express it, could almost see God? You ever been in a place like that? You ever been on a camp out maybe, and at night you're staring up into the heavens, which, by the way, without all the light pollution that the cities make, if you're really in a secluded spot, I recommend that you do that at least once in your lifetime. Go to, there's maps online, you can find the darkest places in Texas. Go there. One of the best ones is in the Big Bend National Park. You can go there in certain places and you look up into the heavens. Folks, you're not going to see what you look into the heavens and see here in San Antonio. What you're going to see is star clusters and galaxies and the Milky Way, which is milky, right? You're going to see God's handiwork on full display, and I guarantee you it will have a dramatic effect on who you think yourself to be. It has a humbling effect, right? I've told you before about first time we were with a church group and we went into the Alps and we come around a corner off of this trail and we're literally Julie Andrews, right? But instead of singing The Hills Are Alive with the Sound of Music, the group I was with broke out spontaneously with How Great Thou Art. It was palpable. It almost frightening just how insignificant we felt. And if you ever get the chance to experience something like, I know we're not all about feelings, but feelings aren't bad. Anything especially that can remind you of the greatness of God, embrace that. embrace that and thank him for that. I believe this indescribable feeling that Barnes talks about here, I believe that's what Paul's talking about in Romans 1, 18 through 20, right? Go ahead and turn there. I'm going to read it, but you can read along with me. Some of you, most of you already know what he says there, but it's worth repeating. Paul says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them." How so? "Because God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse." God has given man an innate knowledge of himself. And the only thing capable of erasing or clouding over that innate knowledge is man's unrighteousness. This is why I've said, and I'll say it again, there's no such thing as an atheist. How do I know that? Because God himself doesn't believe in atheists. He tells us as much. Every man alive is without excuse, at least in terms of understanding that he is. To look at everything around us, and as some are intent to do in their unrighteousness, to attribute everything that exists to chance, to a series of accidents that just happen to work out for our benefit, it's foolish. It's foolish. As one apologist said, if you take a watch and you open the back and you look inside it, who would ever even suggest that that just happened? You know, there was a factory that made watch parts, and all of a sudden one night it just blew up. And when they went in to clean up after the explosion, they found all these watches. Just immediately put together from all these parts. That's silly, right? Do you realize how infinitely more silly it is to believe that everything around us just happened by accident? Don't get me started on this. I mean, I can go on all night about this. Think about the irreducible complexity of one human cell. It will blow your mind. And yet man in his unrighteousness refuses to acknowledge that. Why? Why? Why would man dare try to silence such a clarion voice for the existence of God? I'll tell you why. He knows that the moment he acknowledges God exists, he has to acknowledge that he does not meet God's righteous standards. The reason men deny the existence of God is because they think that in their denial, they're getting away with something. But what are they really doing? They're doing what Job's talking about here. They're attempting to stand against or defy God. Job says, no man has ever been able to do that without harm. Understand that. If you're an unbeliever here tonight, understand, you can deny God. You can deny the gospel. You can refuse to believe all you want, but you're not going to get away with it in the end. I mean, you might live a long, healthy, prosperous life as an unbeliever, but the day's coming. The day's coming. Much better to see today as the day of salvation and cry out to the Lord to save you, and He will. Even though God's presence is beyond our physical perception, when we look around us at all that He has created, when we stop and consider all of the mind-blowing demonstrations of what amounts to really only a fraction of His power and might, those things alone are or should be enough to convince us that even though we can't see Him, He's still there. The ultimate demonstration of His power is going to happen when, as the Apostle John described in his revelation, everything in existence will be rolled up like a scroll. Poof. Gone. Who but God can do that? Wipe out the entire known universe and then bring in a new heavens and new earth at the same time? Think about that power. Think about that God. I don't care what your eschatological position is. I mean, there's coming a day of reckoning, right? Things might get better before then, okay? Praise God, right? Who doesn't want that for our children, our grandchildren? But there's coming a day. We have it on God's authority. There's coming a day when this present heaven, this present earth will be no more. I believe David expressed this idea best in Psalm 8, verses 3 and 4. Remember what he said? He said, "When I behold your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is man that you're mindful of him? Or the son of man that you care for him?" Still a good question, is it not? Wonder of wonders that God cares for any of us. Wonder of wonders that God has any interest at all in sparing any of us from certain wrath. I hope you have that same sense of wonder. Because the minute you lose sight of that, the wonder of it all, you start seeing yourself as perhaps being worthy of God's mercy and grace. You're not, you never were, you never will be worthy, except as He sees you through His Son, Jesus Christ. Which should actually cause more questions than provide answers. Job continues in verse 12. He says, "Were he to snatch away, who could restrain him? Who could say to him, 'What are you doing?'" And again, what's the answer to that rhetorical question? No one can restrain God from doing anything that He has determined to do, and nobody has a right to question what He has decided to do. There's a similar expression used by none other than Nebuchadnezzar, right? Daniel 4:35. Remember what Nebuchadnezzar said here, making Job's meaning even clearer? He said, "All the inhabitants of the earth are counted as nothing, but He does according to His will in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of earth, and no one can ward off His hand or say to Him, 'What have you done?'" Even Nebuchadnezzar, as obstinate and stiff-necked as he once was, even Nebuchadnezzar saw the light, if only briefly. We really don't know what ended up happening to him, but in this particular moment of lucidity, Nebuchadnezzar is able to speak forth volumes of truth. Who's able to look at God and say, "What have you done?" Or, "Why have you done it this way?" Remember Paul's imaginary antagonist in Romans 9. Remember what he says there? "You'll say to me, 'If He's made me this way, then why does He still find fault?'" And what does he say in response to that? "Who are you, O man, who answers back to God? Will the thing formed say to the one who formed it, 'Why have you made me like this?' Does not the potter have the same right over the clay to make one vessel this way and one vessel another way?" What's the answer? Yes, he does. Job's point here is crystal clear. He wants his friend Bildad to understand that whatever's happening in terms of his suffering, and whatever the cause for it might actually be, there's literally nothing that he or anyone else can do about it. Right? If God so intends for these things to befall Job, this is it. This is what's going to happen. He says in verse 13, "God will not turn back His anger. Beneath Him crouch the helpers of Rahab." Some of you are probably looking at your Bibles like, nope, that's not what my Bible says. I mean, the first part of that's not difficult to understand. God will not turn back his anger. Meaning that when God is righteously angry and he's determined to exact his vengeance, there's nothing that can stay his hand. There's nothing that will prevent him from doing just that. Now, this is not to say that God doesn't on occasion withhold his anger, only that guilty man himself can't expect that or demand that from him. When God does withhold his anger, his wrath, even then, it's not his changing from one position to the other. It appears that way from our perspective, but when God does that, it's simply an indication that that was his plan all along, right? So understand that aspect of God's sovereignty, especially when you're reading the Old Testament, when God says, okay, if this happens, I won't do that. He already knew. He already ordained that this would happen and that wouldn't happen, right? So in that way, we are able to preserve his immutability, his unchangeable nature. The second part of this passage, though, is kind of difficult to understand, right? Especially when we understand that this proper name Rahab, what we think is a proper name, which is in the case of Rahab the harlot, but it's not in this case. But never mind that for now, because in some of your translations, the word Rahab doesn't appear at all. The New Living Translation reads this way, "And God does not restrain his anger. Even the monsters of the sea are crushed beneath his feet." The King James Version reads, "If God will not withdraw his anger, the allies of the proud lie prostrate beneath him." So why do some of these passages speak of Rahab while other translations don't? There's actually a really good explanation. This is not a proper name at all. The word Rahab here, even though it's capitalized, that's by mistake because this is another transliteration of a Hebrew word. The Hebrew word simply means the proud ones, the powerful ones. Scholars have determined that this word is not unlike the word Tiamat in Job 7:12, which is translated as sea monster, and that's why we've got that translation in the New Living Translation. This particular reference in Job 7 is based on a popular myth during Job's day. Tiamat, this sea monster, is said to have brought forth a brood of monsters to help her wage war against heaven. And of course, it failed miserably. So what's Job's real point here? Job's point is simple. Even the scariest, most powerful creatures that one can imagine, even if they are rooted in mythology, are no match for God and his anger. He's overstating his case. He's saying, even if right now you're thinking of Rahab or Tiamat, if you're thinking of any of these wild creatures in mythological lore, even they are no match for our God. And this is what leads to Job's asking in verses 14 through 16, "How then can I answer him and choose my words before him? For though I were right, I could not answer. I would have to implore the mercy of my judge. If I called and he answered me, I could not believe that he was listening to my voice." And again, we can see Job here resigning himself to the absolute sovereignty of God. Job understood, at least at this moment, that God was sovereign, and as God works out his sovereign decree among mankind, there's not a single person alive, there's not a mythological creature who exists in the minds of those who believe such things who's any match for him. So Job says, even if I were able to make my case, even if I were able to answer him and choose my words, even if I were right, I couldn't answer. I would have to implore the mercy of my judge, he says. And even if I called and he did answer, I wouldn't believe it. Right? It'd be too wonderful to believe. Now, as I said at the beginning of this, it's at this point that Job's language takes a decided turn. We're going to look at that next time. It's almost like he just changes in midstream, right? From extolling God's power, his might, his sovereign right to do whatever he will with mankind. He turns on a dime to then begin expressing his own frustration over the fact that even though he's innocent, even though he maintains his righteousness, from his perspective, it seemed as though God may in fact be mistaken in how he's treating him. Again, let's give Brother Job a break here. When you're suffering to that level, and you've tried during the whole time to imagine why it might be happening, you've been pulled to and fro by your friends, your own wife said, curse God and die, and you're wondering, what is the source of all this? And you've determined in your heart, I'm not the cause of this. I can absolve myself of any wrongdoing. When you share the opinion that God Himself has of you, that you're a righteous man, blameless, upright, not in a haughty, arrogant way, but just with the realization, I've done nothing to bring this about. Who among us would not at that point say, okay, God, what's up? What are you doing? And why are you doing it? Even though he's just said, no man can do that, he's about to do that. Now, let me just ask you, isn't that comforting? I've told you before, I love, my heroes in the Bible are not the mighty men. They're not the noble men. They're not the men who push down pillars with their strength. And no, my heroes are the weak, the feeble, the frail. Why? Because that's me. My all-time hero is Peter. Not under the illusion that he was the first pope, but simply because Peter and I are so much alike. You know, I'm not one to stand with all the bravado that some people do and say, well, if I was in Peter's shoes and I was in the courtyard that night and the little lady asked me if I was with Jesus, I'd say, yes, ma'am, I was. Take me wherever he's going. Beat me like you're going to beat him. No. What would you do? You would lie like you've never lied in your life, knowing what was about to befall Jesus. Why? Because we're feeble and frail. Now, I pray that I would die an honorable death, that I could be the martyr, that God would infuse me with such grace and such resolve at that very moment. I pray that would be a wonderful thing. But does God do that typically? No, the martyrs are atypical in that. Most of us are normal, feeble, frail. We sing the hymn about that. Prone to wander. God, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. But what? Here's my heart. Take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above. Why do we sing that hymn? We sing it because it's true. We're all only a hair's breadth away from denying Christ. Don't ever lose sight of that. The minute you think you're 10 feet tall and bulletproof, God may very well humble you. Right? And I think that's what Job's experiencing here. And that's the primary takeaway I want us to make note of from tonight's study. God is everything Job says he is and more. No man can defy him without suffering great harm as a result. And I realize that most of us would prefer that he simply take care of those who openly defy him today. But we should still rest very comfortably knowing that everything that Job says here about him is true, and there's coming a day when all things will be set aright. What a glorious day that will be, right? So, any questions?